As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, from Newcastle at PSG and the piss poor penalty call, to Manchester United going tits up at Galatasaray, to Arsenal looking better with a lens and making a real spectacle. We round up all the action from a busy midweek. Plus, we get excited about IFAB's new rules to f*** up football and look ahead to the weekend's treats as the Ten Hag banter bus rolls up on Tyneside and the words that strike fear into Man City. Lads, it's Tottenham. All of that and more in this Totally Football Show. 30th of November, listener, it's your Totally Football Show, and hello to you. We've got here in the studio Colin Miller. Hello, Colin.
Hello, James.
Lovely to see you again. Raphael Honigstein.
Hello, James.
All right, Raph.
Hello.
And Jack Lang, hello to you.
Hi to you, James.
All right. Jack Lang and Galatasaray Man United sitting in a tree, K-I-S-S-I-N-G.
Yeah, absolutely loved it. I mean, I assume we're going to spend 95% of the pod talking about it. But if that's not enough for you, you can read my piece this morning on The Athletic.
You've done a roundup piece of the midweek and you basically just binned all the other games and went strong on that.
Yeah, it's been hard to avoid doing the Man United games, actually, just because they are so... They've got like their own gravitational pull at the moment.
So many goals.
Ridiculous. And even beyond the goal, it could have easily been 6-0. Yeah, just stuff happening wherever you looked and couldn't take my eyes off it.
Stuff happening. Champions League midweek. Let's get a quick roundup of some of the headlines, particularly for the Premier League's representatives who had a mixed time of it. Holders Man City went 2 goals down on Tuesday to RB Leipzig, but then woke up, put on Doku and beat the Germans 3-2 in Paris on Tuesday night. Newcastle took the lead against PSG again, and we're on the verge of another famous victory over the Parisians before, well, that latest VAR meltdown. On Wednesday, Arsenal had themselves a 6-0 win over Lens. Kai Havertz opening the scoring there. Five other players pitching in. PSV also going through from that group. But the game of the round, and Jack, yeah, we could dedicate the whole podcast to it, saw Man United heading to the new Ali Sami Yen for that game with Galatasaray. What a pre-game atmosphere. And what a show we had when the whole thing kicked off.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Ziyech. Kerem'i düşündü. Kerem topu aldı. Kerem gol! Gol! Gol!
Wow, what a build-up to this game. Obviously, all the precedents, historically speaking, then you had the massive rainstorm. Was the game even going to go ahead? When the players came out on the pitch, that wall of noise. And United got off to a dream start. Garnacho and then Bruno Fernandes silencing that Istanbul crowd.
Yeah, it was an incredible start. And this has been Manchester United's Champions League campaign in a nutshell. Taking early leads, looking positive in maybe 20, 25-minute patches, and then not controlling the game, individual mistakes kept coming in again. And it's just been a constant theme. I can't remember a club who've ever had such a dramatic Champions League group stage. Just so many narratives, so many moments, so many memorable incidents, both for good reasons and of course the negative ones too. And this game sort of encapsulated all of that.
26 goals scored across their five matches so far, four and against, of course, 14 of them against Man United. They go 2-0 up, which with United is never that simple, the most dangerous of scorelines, because then the free kicks start happening. Yikes. Rafa.
Don't know where to start with this team. They have spells of real confidence. Going forward, they look like a team that can really hurt almost any opposition. But there is no balance and there's no game management. There is no authority at the back. And you feel that they can concede goals at any given moment. And I must say, it reminds me a little bit of Erik ten Hag's Ajax. They played some amazing stuff, but there was always a sense that they could concede lots of goals
that
as well.
Chelsea game.
Yeah, exactly, James. Mm. Yeah, good memory. No, but I don't know if that's something in the makeup of his game or if it's more United related, but you cannot, I think we all agree on that, you cannot play that way in the Champions League and hope that you're going to get very far. Because outscoring the opposition is just not a viable match plan.
Bruno Fernandes, who concedes the foul, gets caught upfield, gets angry that Scott McTominay is not there doing what he felt was his share of the defensive work, runs back, concedes the foul, and that's the first of the free kicks taken by Hakim Ziyech. I guess there's good former Ajax and there's less good former Ajax, as in the keeper that he was facing, Colin.
Yeah, I mean, those two goals... The first one's a mistake, right? The first one, he you can see on Anna's sort of wrong-footed. He misjudges where Ziyech is going to put it. You understand
brilliantly
that.
Brilliantly taken kick, though, right through the two players splitting the wall and then the slotted
through. Yeah, it's well working. But we all know that Ziyech, what he can do, his technical ability and from set pieces. But that second one, I've watched it back maybe five or six times and I still don't know. And you can sort of see that we can kind of analyze it and be like, well, he's gone the wrong way, he's just not maybe fully aware of what was happening. But I don't know how you can sort of justify that error, especially after what had happened earlier in the game. And this, whenever he'd made those mistakes against Bayern and Galatasaray earlier in the group, you kind of had, well, he's at a new club, he's under a lot of pressure, he's got new teammates, there's maybe a lot of mitigating factors, but he's actually had a run of form which I think has been reasonably settled in, and he looked a bit more confident, he looked like he had his place and this was definitely his position. But last night was just bizarre.
And Nadir, Rick Bladerunner, loads of comment on social media, Rick Bladerunner tweeting, loads of people saying Onana has single-handedly ruined our Champions League campaign. That's reactionary nonsense. It was with both hands, says Rick. Jack, what was your take?
I actually think his teammates might be a bit more annoyed with the first one, because at least the second one, there was more confusion in the area and it was a technical error on his part. But the first one, you could see how annoyed Bruno Fernandes was that there's a massive gap there. It's not a small gap the ball has gone through. And when you set up a wall, it is, I think, convention that it's your responsibility to deal with the other side. And it's not like it was even really in the corner. Like it was kind of two-thirds of the way across the goal on the side he should have been covering. And he didn't even move for it.
If Bruno Fernandes was concerned about his keeper's performance on free kicks, maybe he shouldn't have conceded the second.
Fair.
Mm. I don't know. I mean, he's not the only one to blame. Onana, although I did like your tweet about his performance on the second one. The Brazilians have a phrase for that.
Yeah, lettuce hands. Just
lettuce
that
hands.
Floppy hand that doesn't really do much, even when you get it to the ball.
Okay, after the first Galatasaray free kick, United had re-established their two-goal lead, courtesy of Scott McTominay. But then Galatasaray come back. And this is the thing that we mentioned yesterday on the highlight show, the fact that you get these runs of goals when United concede, they often concede another straight away. Rob Dawson of ESPN pointing out, Champions League this season, they conceded 2 in 4 minutes at Bayern, 2 in 4 minutes at Copenhagen, 2 in 10 minutes against Galatasaray at home, and 2 in 9 minutes at the Ali Sami Yen.
Yeah, I mean, when you concede 14 goals, I think you will find patterns automatically. But it speaks to that sense of weird fragility and lack of composure, lack of balance, all these things. We can, I think, only repeat them. And whereas in the past, I think the main explanation was the changes and the lack of experience. I think you looked at the back four yesterday. And of course, you can argue about individuals, but it was a reasonably experienced back four that had played a lot of games for United. I'm not sure collectively, but certainly individually. And they had an Amrabat, one of the best holding midfielders in terms of specialists. But still, it all adds up to far less than the sum of its parts.
They were also facing an excellent and huge entertaining Galatasaray side. The Ziyech free kicks were very nice. The third goal from Karim the Dream, Aktürkoğlu.
That was amazing. Mm. That was a beautiful goal. I don't think we can blame Onana for that. Although I think some people have because it was the near post. But I think that is totally unsavable.
I think as well, the Scott McTominay comments after the game where he was like, look, you know, he was lamenting the fact that they didn't score more, which was obviously in one hand true because they had a lot of chances to score four for a fifth later on. But it was also the mindset that they have had sort of throughout this group whereby they think they're just going to go out and outscore a team rather than go 2-0 up, 3-1 up and be like, right, you've got to change your approach. You've got to shut up shop here. And they just haven't done that. And McTominay, I quite like Scott McTominay, but he's a player that sort of encapsulates this a bit because Raph is talking about the defence. And I actually think the defence were fine largely last night. I didn't see any sort of structural issues. But it's more the case of, especially when Amrabat went off, there's just little to no midfield protection when you've got McTominay just regularly joining attacks, which obviously adds a goal threat, but it leaves you so wide open, and those spaces in the last, certainly in the last 20, 25 minutes were insane.
Yeah, the substitution on 3-1 by Ten Hag, which was Mainu and Martial on for Amrabat and Højlund.
Yeah, I think Colin's right. I mean, you don't get a lot of protection from Garnacho and Anthony coming back either. So it is a disjointed team, but it is still strange because Ten Hag, the progress he's made last season was based on mostly counter-attacking football, was based on being relatively organised, waiting for teams to come onto them and then break fairly effectively. And we're all waiting this year to sort of see a more fully formed Ten Hag United emerging, a more free-flowing team. Hasn't really happened in the Premier League. They seem to play that in the Champions League, which is very counterintuitive. And as a result, the games are just ridiculously open. And Galatasaray have their own issues. They also play a little bit like that, which made it this ding-dong of a game. Mm. It's just amazing, but probably not sort of Champions League vintage in terms of the overall tactical quality on show.
Yeah, but one of the standout games of the season, I think, anywhere.
Yeah, from a quality perspective, yeah, it's definitely not. It's going to be up there in the Hall of Fame. But in another way, it's kind of a, for me anyway, it taps into a kind of Champions League nostalgia to kind of before the English clubs really established dominance and could reliably beat anyone for that, you know, 15, 20 previous years, really. It reminds me of when Man United would travel to away games. The Juventus ones always spring to mind, but lots of lesser teams too. And there was this kind of sense of peril in the air at all times, thinking, oh, we haven't got this under control. And actually, I think that adds a lot to it as a spectacle. Probably not if you're a hardcore Man United fan, but someone watching this just in search for an exciting game to watch, I think it was probably the best game I've seen for maybe all season.
Extraordinary. United have actually conceded by a long stretch more goals at this point of a Champions League group stage than any English team ever.
Yeah, I was going to say as well, they've conceded just two fewer in the Champions League than they have in the Premier League. And if you watch their games in the Premier League this season, they're quite dull, a lot of them. They're very risk-averse in their play. It's been attack that they've had their issues in. And Champions League, it's just like a different approach. And one of the things as well is a really strange pattern of results. That their last 27 games going into last night, they hadn't drawn any of them. They'd either won or lost. I'm not sure what the sort of record would be for a team going without a draw, but all the way back to that 2-2 against Tottenham at the end of April, so that's 7 months without drawing a match. Seems very strange, and that kind of pattern has been sort of been a bit boom or bust this season. They've been eking out a lot of wins in the league. They've just sort of winning it on that one moment of quality and being reasonably compact. And in the Champions League, it's just, as I said, it's just the complete opposite. It's I don't understand why the approach is so drastically different.
Well, the point means they are still alive in this Champions League group, although they are bottom. They, on match day 6, need to win at home to Bayern Munich, and they also need the other two teams, who will be battling for the second qualifying spot, Copenhagen and Galatasaray, to draw their match, which is going to be taking place in Denmark. Now, the good news, possibly, Rafa, is that Bayern may not approach that match day six fixture with their trademark intensity if their match day five game with Copenhagen is anything to go by, eh?
Yeah, they look tired. They looked a little bit disinterested, came across as half-hearted. They didn't have that many clever moments in the opposition half. Second half was a little bit better without really creating much. It was all very safe, going through the motions, really cold temperatures. Manuel Neuer said afterwards, yeah, it's not good enough. We're all looking forward to the game with Bayern Munich. You cannot expect to be happy with a draw. But it didn't feel as if Bayern approached this as a must-win game because, of course, it wasn't. I think United will draw a different kind of attitude from them because it's Old Trafford, it's a big game, it's Harry Kane coming back to England, it's Thomas Tuchel coming back to England. It's a game that a lot of people will watch and take interest in. And I think Bayern Munich, they have the kind of the self-regard to show up and go for the win. I think they'll take it a lot more seriously. But then there are probably a few percentage points that once they're gone, it's very hard to get them back, and they might make a big difference. If you are, at, I don't know, 93% in your position, who might be not as good a team functioning overall, will play with a high intensity, that might be enough to balance things out. But it's going to be really interesting, which is much more than I had anticipated, because I thought by the time they meet again on match day six, it's going to be pretty dead rubber, but it's a live rubber.
Mm. And Bayern on Wednesday night, for the first time in 18 group stage games, not getting the victory. 0-0 it finished with Copenhagen. There was actually a late chance for Bayern to win when there was a big appeal for a handball penalty. And watching it, I think having seen Livramento's at the Parc des Princes the previous night, that's a stonewall, cast iron.
I don't think there's such a thing anymore as a stonewall penalty.
Well, we'll come on to the whole penalty issue next on the Totally Football Show.
We're sponsored for this episode of the Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. It's your perfect teammate, the Sutton to your Shearer, the Heskey to your Owen, the Mane and Firmino to your Salah. Whether you're selling I Belong to Jimbo t-shirts or Max and Barry half and half scars, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to the Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally.
Before you get back to this Athletic podcast, did you know it's just one of many made by The Athletic every week? I'm Abby Patterson, senior producer here at The Athletic, and I get to work across so many of our shows. But even I have my favourites. Sometimes you're just too busy for a full-length podcast. I get it. We've all been there. Well, we've got a show to help you. Get up to speed with all the football stories you need to know about with our daily football briefing.
It's done and dusted. Saudi Arabia will host the 2034 World Cup.
Got a bug for the women's game? Then Full-Time Europe is for you. It's our dedicated women's football podcast answering the questions you're asking from the WSL and Champions League.
So what's going wrong at Arsenal?
But perhaps you want to know exactly how a team has set itself up. Then come to the audio whiteboard and join Michael Cox and our analytics gurus as they dissect and examine the game like nobody else can. That's on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast.
I don't think I've ever seen a striker who reads the game so well.
Just search The Athletic wherever you're listening to this podcast now, and you'll find your next podcast obsession in no time at all. Now, let's get back to your show.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Mats Hummels hat es, glaube ich, neulich gesagt. Na, vermutlich bestätigt sie ihn. Nee, doch nicht. Hey.
Yeah, late on at the Allianz Arena, what looked like a clear handball by the standards of the one given against Livramento on Tuesday night, not given. And that wasn't the only one we saw on Wednesday. There was also one on Havertz that wasn't given in the Arsenal game, and one on McTominay in the Galatasaray game.
One in the Braga game as well.
Was there,
quite,
yeah.
Oh, I thought it was quite a
obvious
light.
One. Yeah.
Right. And again, having seen what happened on Tuesday and the apparent metric by which these things are being judged, I think we all thought, those are all going to be given. And on each case, they were overturned. We were positing on Wednesday that maybe a directive had come down from UEFA, who in the meantime had removed the VAR official in charge of the PSG Newcastle game on Tuesday, had stood him down for Wednesday night's action. Some debate as to why he was taken off. Jules claims that it wasn't about the Livramento decision. It was about an earlier Anthony Gordon foul that wasn't given.
On Hakimi. But, I don't think it was a foul.
Okay. Anyway.
It felt as if UEFA had said, look, we're giving away too many weird penalties. People are getting a bit upset. Cut down on it. But in a way they didn't, because a lot of these were still referred to VAR, and then on the second look, then they decided not to give it. Stephanie Frappard, the referee at the Bayern game, she had given it on the pitch. She was very well positioned. And VAR actually told her to look at it because they thought it's possibly not a penalty, which, yeah, was very strange. It's hard to square what we see on the pitch with what the law is or we think it is. Things seem to be very fluid and change from week to week.
Yeah, indeed so. Well, let's talk about the one that was given on Tuesday. One night in Paris, did we see someone get screwed in this game? I think a lot of people would say yes.
C'est un moment très important pour Paris dans la carrière également de Mbappé avec le PSG. Et il la met. Le sauveur du PSG s'appelle inévitablement Kylian Mbappé.
Newcastle, who have beaten PSG at St James's Park, handed them an epic humiliation. And we all thought, well, Luis Enrique surely learnt lessons from that, but no. The same thing was unfolding. Alexander Isaac opening up the scoring after a bit of a mistake from Donnarumma. Then total dominance from PSG. I think they had about 73% of possession. They had an XG in the game of 4.47. Most of the chances falling to the unfortunate Bradley Barcola, who was, I don't know if you could hear what Jules was shouting at him from London, but cheapers. Bobby Barcola, as we dubbed him. But it took until the 98th minute before that penalty was given, and then PSG earned their point with Mbappe's penalty.
Yeah, the Newcastle approach for this game seemed to be really, really different from the home match, which is understandable because that was all about feeding off the atmosphere, feeding off just the intensity that match was. And I think there were signs of it in the first half an hour, certainly, whenever they took the lead and we saw Anthony Gordon and Alexander Isak. They do what they do best in terms of just hassling defenders, Miguel Almiron too, just really pressing high up and just forcing those mistakes. And so I guess kind of making the opposition rethink how they're playing. But certainly in the second half, certainly in the last sort of 30, 25 minutes, they seemed to stop playing and retreat into their shell. And we saw PSG have chance after chance, and they really should have put this game to bed almost in terms of winning it long before the penalty decision came up. And I guess that's partly forced by Newcastle having so many absentees at the moment. Maybe their squad's feeling the effects of quite a rigorous campaign. But yeah, Barcola was, he probably should have had two or three goals by himself, and that would have sealed PSG's progress. That would have eliminated Newcastle. But now the group's still open. Going into the final match in Milan, of course, they'll have a chance too. So it'll be really interesting to see how that game goes at St James's Park between them and Newcastle.
On one hand, it was a heroic performance by Newcastle, back to the wall and that. But on the other hand, as you say, if you do retreat that much, you do invite this kind of incident occurring. If you basically spend the last, 30 minutes camped in your own penalty box?
I don't think it's heroic when you give away so many shots and of course, you can say some amazing saves from Nick Pope, but there were some just really bad misses. And I think there's a big degree of sort of outcome bias here. You know, if they concede two or three goals, they'd be killed. for the performance, saying it's negative, it's naive, you know, why did we start defending so early? That was a point that Isak made himself after the game. If the opposition miss all your chances, you look like you're having a brilliant game defensively, but they really didn't. But of course, it hurts, and it really hurts to concede a penalty that was so contentious. I must say, when I saw it first live, I thought it looked like a pen. A lot of PSG players felt it was a pen. They were all immediately onto the ref. The stadium thought it was a pen, and it wasn't one of those shouts where they all just kind of create something out of nothing. I think there was a real sense that something had happened here. The referee had seen absolutely nothing, but I think he was on the wrong side. And then my reading of the story is that VAR, they didn't necessarily tell him, you made a terrible error here, you have to go and look. But under the directive of missing a serious incident, they can also say to the referee, you probably haven't seen this at all, go over and see what you think. And I don't know if UEFA think that was already too much and they should have just said nothing, or if indeed there were other reasons why the VAR was stood down. Mm. But I think the referee then, on balance, made a wrong decision, because while the arm might have been initially a little bit high, by the time it actually makes contact, it's really low and a very natural movement. And I think you can't really give that penalty.
And this is the thing with VAR, is that one of the key positives, or one in theory, should be that it takes out the emotion. It takes out the fact that 40,000 whatever home fans are screaming for this. You've got multiple players on the referee's case. And he did stand firm. And Rafa's right. When I saw this first, I was like, that's a handball. You can see it coming off his hand. But when you look at the replay, you sort of think, well, it really isn't. I mean, it hits part of his body first. It's just, it's not a penalty. It shouldn't be a penalty. And then whenever a referee is referred to the monitor, this is the thing. It's just, there's just an expectation that he will give it. I think there's an expectation. It's more psychological than anything else, that even if you haven't been told it in so many words, it's, you have made a mistake here and you should correct it. And when you see it hitting a hand, regardless of how it hit that hand, then you begin to doubt yourself, especially with UEFA's sort of description of what a handball should be, which is incredibly, I think, incredibly harsh.
Okay.
We'll talk more about rules and that later on. But how does it leave the group? Dortmund, on 10 points, are mathematically through to the last 16. They will be hosting PSG on the final match day, while Newcastle get a battered Milan. Milan, who left the San Siro in bits after their clash with Dortmund on Tuesday night. 3-1 defeat for the Rossoneri, which means they are now bottom of the group behind Newcastle on goal difference.
Battered like a cotoletto milanese.
If you will. Yeah. If you will. If you will. And they will be visiting St. James's on match day 6. Wow. You'd give Newcastle a strong chance. If Dortmund beat PSG, PSG just 2 points ahead of Newcastle, and Newcastle win that game, Newcastle are through. I fancy Newcastle to do Milan at St. James's. What about Dortmund against PSG?
Dortmund will be up for it. They'll be really up for it. They said straight after the final whistle, we want to win the group. It's PSG. It's not a club they particularly like. They've had a few meetings in the past. Do you remember when Erling Haaland celebrated his goal and the PSG team made a bit of fun of him in the second leg when they won? And I think also Dortmund want to show, in a way, that there's a kind of, don't want to go overboard, but there's a sort of a romantic or perhaps slightly ideological part to them coming through in this game against two nation state owned teams and a hedge fund run.
In this group.
Aside, even though Milan haven't spent all that much money, of course. So I think they'll be really out to win this game. So that should be encouraging for Newcastle.
Excellent. We shall see in a fortnight's time. Elsewhere, Jack, what else made your roundup? Arsenal being amazing, scoring 5 goals in the first half of a Champions League game for the first time ever.
I didn't write about them, but that was very impressive. I think it was the first time that front six had started together, which I think was probably what many people expected to be their strongest midfield and attack. And they all scored. Barring Declan Rice.
Right. Jorginho even scored a penalty.
Jorginho, with no little stutter.
Did he change
his technique, yeah.
Okay.
Which is quite interesting. But yeah, they were very impressive. I also liked, you know, the Man City game was a decent match, but Luis Openda, I thought, was sensational in just the way he kind of bullied the City defence. Rafa will obviously have watched a lot more of him than us, but seems to be very like, unassuming player. There's no kind of, I don't know, no kind of star aura to him yet. He's kind of like shuffles around, his head down, and yet he's just explosively good. I think he's a very good player.
Very nice. You should also give a shout out in reference to the Dortmund-Milan game to Jamie Bynoe-Gittens, who made only his fifth start of the season at San Siro and was kind of the star of the show.
He was, I think, yeah. He won the penalty, scored the goal, caused all sorts of trouble. Yeah, the player that Dortmund have been expecting and have been hoping for is finally kind of emerging because his development has been hampered by a couple of shoulder injuries. And now he's getting a bit more game time. He feels fully fit and he makes a big difference for the Dortmund team because he combines the pace of, let's say, Daniel Malen or Karim Adeyemi, but also with the trickery and the awareness of some of the slower players like Royce or Reina. So he's like two players in one. And Dortmund think he's going to be absolutely the next massive big thing from England via Dortmund.
Okay, the previous big thing from England via Dortmund also had a big night. I mean, midweek, Wednesday in Real Madrid's game against Napoli, Jude Bellingham scoring the second of Real Madrid's goals, I think, and then sealing the win with a magnificent assist for the fourth goal, I think it was, wasn't it? 4-2 win in the end, but it was tight this game. It went right down to the final minutes with Napoli looking for, when they were 3-2 down, looking for an equaliser before Jude sorted it out.
Yeah, Real Madrid sort of saw them off quite late on, but it was a really fun game. Napoli still not through, but probably will make it. They're still not through, are they?
No, they're still not through. They're going to be facing Braga, who also have hopes of making the last 16, but Braga are going to be in Naples and need to win by at least two goals.
So Napoli still not through after this result, but I suppose they give quite a good showing. But yeah, Real Madrid in Champions League are Real Madrid in the Champions League, and Jude Bellingham again comes up trumps. What was interesting about this match is it a lot of second generation footballers made a bit of a name for themselves. So Diego Simeone's son, Giovanni, opened the scoring for Napoli. And Diego Simeone used to play alongside Pablo Paz for Argentina at the 98 World Cup. And Pablo Paz's son, Nico, scored his first goal for Real Madrid later on in that game. But more than this, was it Diego Simeone scored his first goal against Real Madrid in a 4-2 loss at the Bernabeu. And Giovanni Simeone scored his first goal against Real Madrid in a 4-2 loss at the Bernabeu.
No.
And not only this, but as Tim Lee points out, Santiago Canizares was a substitute goalkeeper for Real Madrid in Diego Simeone's goal game. And Santiago Canizares' son Lucas was the substitute goalkeeper last night. And not only that, but Theo Zidane, who is one of the four Zinedine Zidane's sons, who are professional footballers, have come through Real Madrid's academy, was on the bench for Real Madrid. Now, he didn't get on, but he is expected to maybe play a part for them at some point this season. He's 21. I don't think there's an expectation that he will form part of their squad, but his brothers Enzo and Luca are still professionals and they'd come through Madrid's academy, and his younger brother Elias, who's 17, is also there. So yeah, there's a lot of second generation players are coming through at the moment, and a lot of them were involved last night.
All right. Atleti, Diego Simeone's side, also went through midweek. They won at Feyenoord. Lazio from that group going through to the last 16 and ending Celtic's hopes of finishing anywhere but last in that group. Barcelona progressed to the last 16. They beat Porto, came from behind with goals from the Joao's, Cancelo and Felix. And in a big week for comebacks, we had Inter at the Stade de Luz going 3-0 down. And how did that one finish?
3-0.
3-0.
João Mário hat-trick.
Yeah.
We had some really amazing
games
on Matchday 5. I'm already feeling nostalgic for
the Champions League
stage. Yeah. The group stage, yeah. Soon to be gone.
So how's it going to work next year?
It's going to be a league.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you'll have 8 games.
Right.
And you'll play 8 random teams. Well, they're not completely random because they'll be rated. So you'll play 2 good ones, 4 medium ones, 2 bad ones, roughly. And home and away will be random. And in theory, you'll have more sort of interesting matchups because it's not always the same teams and you have a bit more variety. But whether that works out into a sort of cohesive, it's going to be really interesting if we finish 13th or 14th kind of scenario is yet to be seen. But it, of course, it adds two more games, which is the main thing for the clubs. They want more games, more money, TV rights, etc. But it could freshen things up a little bit.
One of the things that will happen is that teams will finish level on points or even level on goal difference, and one of them will advance based on almost a technicality, but they've played entirely different teams, which to me, that's the major flaw in that system, whereby, yeah, there'll be rankings and there'll be seedings, but you're playing entirely different teams and you're being ranked on those points. It doesn't really seem to make a whole lot of sense, but it is more matches, and that's the point.
Okay, we've got one final round of this Champions League group stage. It's in a fortnight's time. It's going to be a belter by the sound of it. Anyway, before that, Premier League returns this weekend with Match Day 14, which offers all sorts of delights, including a chance for Ten Hag and Eddie Howe, who compare notes on their European misadventures on Saturday evening. Let's talk about the weekend's action next.
Hello, listeners. Danny Kelly here, host of The View from the Lane, your dedicated Spurs podcast from The Athletic. Myself, Charlie Eccleshare, James Moore and Tim Spears are with you twice a week every week this season as we bring you all the news and views you could ever possibly want from in and around the club. Listen for free wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to follow and subscribe so you don't miss a single episode of The View from the Lane.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson, the Football Content Awards International Podcast of the Year.
Premier League Match Day 14, no early kickoff on Saturday. If you're looking forward to that, not going to happen. Got five games on the Sunday as well. Let's have a look. Now, on Saturday at 3 o'clock, there's Brentford-Luton, table-topping Arsenal hosting Wolves, and a big relegation scrap between bottom of the table Burnley and Sheffield United. Then at 5:30, Forest take on Everton. And at 8 o'clock, Newcastle, Man United. Sunday, four games at 2 o'clock. There's Bournemouth Villa, the Harry Redknapp domicile Clasico. Chelsea Brighton, Liverpool Fulham, and West Ham Crystal Palace. Which one is on TV of those four?
West Ham.
West Ham Crystal Palace, yay. Then at 4:30, Man City Spurs. Man City Spurs, all right.
I'm going to that one.
Are you going to Man City Spurs? I'd have picked that too.
If I get there, because there's no trains.
Ah.
Yeah, I have to drive.
All right.
This was the match last season when Tottenham scored two goals before halftime to take a two-goal lead, and Man City were booed off. And Pep had his, "We are a happy flowers team. I don't want this," press conference after. They went on to win the game 4-2, but there was a real sense at
happy
that
what?
Time.
Happy florists.
Happy flowers.
Happy flowers.
Happy flowers.
I'm not sure exactly what he was trying to say with that exactly. Because I don't think it was really a mistranslation as such. Or,
Pep kind of speaks his own coded language that I think only maybe some other members of the Man City staff understand. But a lot of times it kind of flies over my head, certainly. That is a game that they won against Spurs, but they've actually lost five of their last seven Premier League meetings with Tottenham Hotspur, who also knocked them out of the Champions League, famously, in 2019. Why is that? And could it happen again this weekend?
Well, this is a very different Spurs to the one that's been kryptonite for City. The one that they haven't enjoyed playing against was the counter-attacking Spurs of Mourinho, of Conte. Even Nuno managed to beat them in his first game. I think might have been his only win.
I think he won his first three, didn't he? We all thought this is brilliant. Anyway, yeah.
I digress. Postecoglou's Spurs is a very different animal, and I think it might actually suit City more, because once you get through the press, there will be spaces, and it could be a very open game, which I think will suit City a lot more than Spurs.
City are being quite open at the moment. We've seen seven goals conceded in the last three. Jack, you mentioned Openda. Will the likes of Heung-min Son look at what Openda did and think, ooh.
Possibly, but the supply line isn't as good as it may have been a few weeks ago. Probably not ideal to be playing Brian Hill in a game like this. I wonder if he might push Giovanni Lo Celso a bit further forward, maybe make him the creator and kind of stiffen up the central midfield a bit. But it's at the other end, I think, that, yeah, things are probably going to be in City's favour. Erling Haaland against that kind of defensive four made up of only of fullbacks, I would probably fancy his chances. And yeah, I see goals in this one. And with Spurs, the way they are, a little bit fractured, a bit gassed with so many players out, I think City will win this fairly comfortably, actually.
Okay. Spurs currently in fifth place, having lost three straight games. They're only 3 points behind Man City, though, so if they do manage to do a Tottenham on them, that would certainly shake things up. The other teams in that mix at the top, Arsenal, who are in first place, a point ahead of City, will be hosting Wolves. Wolves, who have, of course, already beaten the team leading the league once already this season when they did Man City at Molineux in September.
Yeah, they seem to come alive in these matches, don't they? Obviously beaten Tottenham as well. And they even though the two goals came quite late in that game, they really deserved that. They were far the better team. They were a bit unlucky against Man United at Old Trafford. They probably should have beaten Newcastle as well, that game that finished 2-2. So, I mean, they've got a few key midfielders missing through suspension. So you kind of fancy with Arsenal having home advantage, they should do this. But then you're never quite sure, especially after the Champions League midweek games. I know Arsenal maybe didn't expend too much energy in terms of such a comfortable win. But Wolves, there's this deep sense of injustice around Wolves at the moment, with so many VAR penalty decisions that have gone against them. Monday night's defeat at Fulham was another example of this.
Right, yeah. So Wolves, who've actually conceded 5 penalties this season, a lot of them contentiously. Arsenal, who've been awarded more than anybody else, 6. So this could be another big game for spot kicks.
So Arsenal fans are convinced that the referees and VAR have got it in for them. So it just shows you.
There you go. Wolves beaten in their previous trip to London this Monday night, as you mentioned, 3-2 at Fulham. And the third in particular, quite egregious. And Gary O'Neill saying afterwards that he was done with VAR. I'm not sure where that leaves VAR.
Yeah, I think
it's over now.
He is, if Arsenal are kind of the club, he's the single person around whom VAR seems to have like ganged up at the moment. He seems enormously personally aggrieved.
Right.
I haven't turned on Match of the Day for about 4 months without Gary O'Neill kind of angrily looking to camera and calling it a disgrace. And I mean, as much as I dislike people claiming conspiracy, he's kind of got a point, because some of them have been absolutely awful decisions.
It's nice that you're able to maintain contact with Gary O'Neill despite his move to Wolves, because you used to be regulars together in the gym, didn't you?
I'm surprised about how much mileage I've got out of this anecdote, but yeah, I've seen him in my gym on more
Where
than
is this
one
gym?
Occasions. In South London, Beckenham.
Okay.
The only extra detail I can give you is that he was on Y Scout there once when he was managing Bournemouth. So if I'd been a better journalist, I could have gleaned some insight.
Scooped whoever he was scouting. Mm. Yeah, interesting. What kind of exercises did he do mostly, Jack? What kind of routine?
I only saw him in the cafe.
Right.
But he looks like he's in shape. I'm sure he's out all over everything.
Isn't this some kind of unwritten code that what happens in the gym kind of stays in the gym? Or
yeah, it's a gentleman's agreement. I wouldn't trouble the man during his off hours.
All right, beaten by Fulham on Monday. Fulham themselves are going to be at Liverpool this Sunday, 2:00. Liverpool, who are a point behind Man City in third place, 2 points off the top. They're going to be without Alisson for a few weeks, so Kevin Kelleher will likely be deputising. Ooh, Fulham will have João Paulinho back from suspension, so there's that. And the other top four team, who are Aston Villa, level actually on points with Liverpool, and only 2 points off the top, are at Bournemouth Sunday at 2:00. I mean, the weekend could end with Villa top of the table. Amazing. You like a bit of who's on the bench and backstory, Colin. How about Iraola and Emery?
Yeah, I did a piece earlier this year on coaches who are from the Gishbuchka region of the Basque country, which is where Real Sociedad play. And this is a very, it's the smallest area geographically in Spain, and it's like the 18th by population, whatever. But it's quite small, and they produce an incredible amount of top-level coaches, of which Andoni Iriola, Unai Emery, Julen Lopetegui, Mikel Arteta, Xabi Alonso, Javi Gracia, Imanol Aguasil, who's the Real Sociedad coach. They've got this sort of...
they're all from there?
Yeah. It's incredible. It really is incredible. It's remarkable in terms of how... I'm not sure how you can quite explain the volume of it in terms of that part of the Basque country. The Basque country in general has very high levels of participation in sport, and you can see that certainly through the youth academies of Real Sociedad and Athletic Club. But yeah, it's just remarkable the sort of high-level coaches that it has been churning out on a regular basis. And Andoni Iriola, who is starting to probably turn things around at Bournemouth. I mean, I watched the game when they beat Newcastle 2-0, and they were all over Newcastle that match. They were fantastic. And again, they won at Sheffield United last time out. Probably could have won by more. And over the international break, he did a big interview in the Spanish press. And he was asked, you know, it was a tough start to the season. You know, can players adapt to your methods, or are you thinking of changing it? And he's like, no. I'm just thinking of going much harder. Like, if it's not working, we just need to press more. We need to press higher up. We need to take more risks. And it seems that the players are now starting to really buy into it. And he's doing really well, as of course is Unai Emery at Aston Villa, as we've spoken about before. So yeah, I mean, it's a big test. It's a big test up for Villa, and their away record isn't too great.
They've lost actually the last two visits to the Vitality Stadium. So, yeah. Bournemouth, who are in 16th place, they've got a healthy 7-point margin over the bottom three as it stands. But there you go. All right. Is that a fixture that excites you?
I think there are others that are slightly more appealing.
We'll come on to maybe one or two of those next.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
It's the final of the Under-17 World Cup on Saturday in Surakarta, Indonesia. That's probably one of the games you were talking about, Rafa, because it features Germany's Under-17 side, and they're facing France. Game kicks off at noon UK time. This, of course, the tournament that England won 6 years back with a side managed by Steve Cooper. Phil Foden was in there, Mark Gray, Morgan Gibbs-White and Callum Hudson-Odoi at Forest now. Jack?
That was an amazing batch of players. So I went to the Under-17 World Cup in 2019 in Brazil for The Athletic. But I think that my trip there just underlines how fragile potential can be at that age. So I did a series on the young players to watch. I did, I think, one a day over 8 or 9 days. And every now and again I'd check on them. And it's telling that I have to check on them because none of them have really kicked on, like players that were the best players at the tournament.
So it's rare that England got that many established stars.
I think so, yeah. And I think, it's a lottery. It's a bit of it's a cliche to say, but it really is because so many factors can play into it. But I think that batch of players, that's a remarkable outlier, I would say, rather than something we could expect for most teams.
Okay. Who are the Forest stars of the future in Germany's Under-17 side for Sunday?
Well, Paris Brunner is getting a lot of love because he's scoring the important goals that got Germany to the final. That's all I can think of at this point.
Named after City of Conception style?
It could be.
All right. More international news. the encouragingly named International Rules Board, IFAB, have been meeting this week to make changes. Thank goodness, because we do need the handball sorted out. Long overdue.
If
what's
only,
that? Nothing
only
on handballs? No, instead, they've announced Tuesday, they just dropped this casually, in the middle of a Champions League week. Oh, yeah, we're going to bring in sin bins at higher levels, air quotes, after successful, they say, grassroots tests. This is in response to dissent towards officials. The big issue.
And cynical fouls.
Afflicting the game. Sorry? And cynical fouls as well.
Just more contentious in my view.
Okay. Sin bins have been trialled in English football, it says here, since 2019-20, not since 1920. A trip to the sin bin will mean a player both receiving a yellow card and being removed from the field for 10 minutes. Although there won't actually be a physical sin bin like in hockey,
a
which is
a shame.
Real disappointment. Nick Miller's written about the pros and cons on The Athletic, and he breaks that news to us. One of the first responses underneath from readers is, make them do laps instead, which I think is an excellent.
Well, they need to keep warm. That's a serious point.
Actually, yeah.
Yeah.
IFAB are very excited about this. You tweeted in context to this, worth remembering that FIFA claimed in 2016, their trial of VAR, that they anticipated that VAR would be required once every 4 or 5 games, with checks to take no longer than 6 seconds. How'd that work out?
Yeah, it sounds completely made up, but that was the sort of pretense under which that was introduced. And
so
yeah.
These are the kind of expectations, the kind of good intentions that they maybe approach these changes with. What do we feel about the idea of 10-minute sin bins and all the kind of delays that are going to go with that?
I actually think in theory, it is actually a very exciting prospect because it would just change so much, right? I mean, it would change how managers approach matches so much in terms of how they think, in terms of like tactical fouls and that sort of thing, whereby, you know, those sort of challenges and sort of back chat to officials, which are so commonplace. Would it completely stamp that out? And then if you're down a player for 10 minutes, you'd have to completely change your tactical approach to a match.
Or you substitute him.
Well.
Oh, no, you can't do that.
You can't do that. And this, it's such a radical approach. Now, I mean, it's a lot of fun to think about the sort of potential implications. But in theory, it does sort of seem just like total chaos. And that's the last thing that football needs to do right now. I just think that it's kind of got like that as it is.
I have to say, if you would look at hockey and go, there's one rule I want to bring in, it wouldn't be sin bins. I'd have fighting, first of all. Let the players go at it. And then, as I always mention, the offside rule, which is brilliantly simple in hockey, and we don't have any trouble with that. Yeah. Rafa, you were questioning this business of cynical fouls as being a really difficult thing to be judged.
I mean, in theory, everyone knows what a cynical foul is.
But how do you... I mean, that's a question of intent, isn't it?
It's a question of intent. It's a question of, you know, when does a foul become cynical? When is it merely sarcastic? I don't know what the... lesser version of that would be. And I also, I must say, I think professional fouls, cynical fouls of that nature, I think one of football's great sort of civilizing achievements, the idea that you can foul someone, but you do it in a way not to hurt them.
Mm.
And I think it'd be a shame to take that away because it could lead to the very unintended consequence of people having to try really hard to foul a player in a more brutal way, not to be judged to be the foul being cynical. So you have to kind of make crazy attempts to play the ball when you can't, thereby endangering yourself and the opponent. But to show to the referee this wasn't a cynical little pullback or whatever. So I don't know. I also think there is, while we all know what that classic cynical foul is, I think there's a lot of fouls where they, of course, have a tactical element because you're beaten by your man and you foul him. It might not be in the center circle. It might not be a counterattack, but is it really that much of a difference? So I'm not sure that's a really good idea. And just lastly, I think another unintended consequence is that you won't see teams pressing high. You won't see teams going for it with lots of men because you kind of have to keep people back because, you know, once they're beyond you, they basically become untouchable and you can't foul them anymore. And therefore, I think we might see the tactical pendulum swing back to a lot more defensive football with people staying back. Plus, once you're then a man down, that won't encourage free-flowing football either. So I don't know. I think with the descent, just to say my final word on this, I get the sense that if FIFA, UEFA, all the leagues and the referees would just clamp down and descend a bit stronger with yellow cards, which I saw some signs of that happening this season, you wouldn't have to have this debate, because you do it once or twice and you send maybe even send somebody off for doing it twice, I think the chilling effect would be strong enough without having to introduce a different colour of cardboard in the referees' trousers.
Although I think there's still going to be yellow, confusingly, Jack.
Yeah, I think we should do handballs as well. Just take all subjectivity out of it.
How?
I semi-genuinely think.
Yeah.
I haven't thought through the consequences of this.
Yeah.
But I'm willing to start a debate on it.
Yeah.
Anytime it touches the hand, just give a penalty. Just remove
anywhere on the field.
Remove the deliberate thing. Yeah.
Right.
No, obviously not.
But then you'll have anywhere on the field. Then you'll just have people trying to hit somebody's arms.
I'm okay with that.
It's a skill.
No, it's ridiculous.
Is it any more ridiculous than what we've got now?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, then.
I'll reflect.
So it'll be happening soon by the sound of it. All right.
The thing that grates most, apart from the ever-changing and evolving handball definitions, is the punishment doesn't seem to fit the crime. You often get very innocuous situations at the edge of the box, a ball that comes in but wouldn't have gone anywhere, and suddenly you go from a very low-scoring chance, or who knows if it even results in a chance, to a 75% chance.
Yeah.
I think if they could find
a way of...
Maybe just indirect free kicks, unless it's in the 6-yard box or unless it's clearly going towards goal. Just downgrade the punishment. Then it doesn't have to become such a big deal anymore.
The threshold for penalties definitely needs to be higher. It definitely needs to be higher, because it's too much of a 75-80% chance of a goal. It shapes and defines matches based on innocuous moments. It needs to, like, those are the sort of technicalities that could be changed, but I mean, again, you're going over these things, and it feels like the more changes come in, the more chaotic it gets, the less consistency there is too, the less common sense there might be, and that's one of the things that you're always debating between. But I just think the more things change, the more complicated it tends to become, certainly for officials.
Indeed.
That indirect free kick.
What more?
That indirect free kick thing is a much better idea than mine. So,
okay. Meantime, this weekend in the Premier League, there's some other big games that we should mention. This Saturday, indeed, at 8 o'clock, it's 7th against 6th on Tyneside. Man United have been to hell. Now they meet the Pope. Newcastle have already beaten Man United this season, with their reserves, in fact, about a month ago in the Carabao Cup at Old Trafford.
It's not a... Is it a Pope, technically? Rather than the Pope.
The Pope.
Pope.
The Pope. They've also had 5 home wins in a row, those Magpies. Good Lord, with an aggregate score across those 5 matches of 12 goals for and just 1 against. Is it going to be another rough night for Erik ten Hag's boys?
Well, as looking at Newcastle's record after their Champions League games this season. Now, they did win 8-0 at Sheffield United, so that's the massive caveat here. But they did draw at West Ham, they drew at Wolves, and that defeat at Bournemouth also came after a Champions League game. And I think that those matches, they're not just draining sort of physically, but also psychologically, right? I mean, especially that PSG match, whereby you're defending for so long and then you concede right at the end. Whereas I think with Man United, obviously they've been to Istanbul a day later, but it kind of feels like they've more options in their squad. And also I think there's more of a sense that despite that result, they certainly seem to be evolving a bit as a team. Players seem to be coming back into their side rather than losing more players through injury. So I kind of think Man United, if you're going to go to Newcastle, this might be the best time to do it, albeit they did beat Chelsea 4-1 there last week, and I said the exact same thing then, so it's tricky. But I think Newcastle might be a little bit vulnerable in this match.
Ah, okay. Well, Newcastle have surprised us in the past. As you mentioned, they are just a point behind United on the fringes there of the European places. Chelsea, who are 8 points below Man United, down in 10th place, have a big game Sunday at 2 o'clock when they'll be taking on Brighton. Oh, they also met in the Carabao Cup in September, and that was a 1-0 win for Chelsea at Stamford Bridge. What do you think about Chelsea? Conceding 4 goals in each of the last 2 games?
Yeah, I can't really get a handle on them, because just when you think Maurizio Pochettino is starting to bring a bit of coherence they showed something against Man City, for example. Against Tottenham, that was too weird to judge. And against Newcastle, obviously get thrashed. Sparks, I think, like green shoots, I would say, but still more questions than answers. Like I expected the midfield to be a little better. I thought we would see a kind of quite solid Caicedo, Enzo Fernandez base, but there's a lot of Conor Gallagher going on for me, and I know he's Chelsea through and through and all that, but I don't think he's good enough to be playing week in, week out for a team of Chelsea's ambitions, just on a technical level. Hope he's not listening. I'm sure he's a lovely guy. But that's just one of the players in the upper echelons of the league that I just can't quite get my head around.
Meantime, players who won't be there for Brighton include Lewis Dunk, who got a straight red card for a foul and abusive language. And it was a sin bin for him. First Premier League player to be shown a straight red for dissent in over a decade. Last one was Lee Catamol back in 2011. Also, Mo Dahoud, who's been sent off as well recently. And Ansu Fati and Tarek Lamptey are both out to injury for a fair while. For Chelsea, Reece James is suspended. Sorry, Colin, you were going to say.
Yeah, I was going to say that a lot of Chelsea players feel like that to me, whereby I just don't know if they're really at the standard that Chelsea demands. Really, I mean, Chelsea should be definitely a top four club. You look at the money they've spent, obviously, but the expectations that they've set over the past 15, 20 years, that this is a club who, and a fan base, who are used to winning. Mm. And obviously Pochettino's sort of Tottenham background kind of, you think, might play into that from a fan point of view, but it feels like the players he's got to work with, it's such a hodgepodge squad. It seems to be made up of they've made such a big deal out of the kind of the low average age. I'm not sure that's necessarily a good thing, in the sense that a lot of these players are at a reasonably early stage still of their development. And it doesn't seem to be the best environment for them to really find their best form. And like these results that Chelsea have got are against top teams, and they're reasonably positive in terms of certainly the win at Tottenham and the result against City. But Pochettino embraces that chaos. He really likes those games where he's like, right, we have a lot of energy. If we just sort of press high up, this team are good, but we've got some good players too. We can sort of go toe-to-toe with that. But there's so many points that they have dropped, and I think will continue to drop against teams who are in the bottom half of the league, because there doesn't seem to be an alternative way of playing. And a large part of that is because of the squad that he has. I just don't think it's enough to, well, maybe a top five finish will get Champions League football this year. I just don't think it's enough for that.
One of the key members of that squad on his way back from injury could make a big difference. And Nkunku, where are we at with that? Because he was running around training pitches recently.
I think he's very close to getting some minutes. And I think he will really transform this team. He's that good. I was beginning to think that no matter how many weird signings and players are getting thrown at, Pochettino is beginning to make sense of it all and finding a formation, finding a team. But then they had this big setback, and he went for them big time, questioning their attitude. And it was strange to see them so outplayed to that extent and not showing up, because they have all week to prepare for these games, and that should be a massive, massive advantage.
His perhaps greatest run in English football coming, of course, at a club which wasn't making any signings at all for a year and a half. So, interesting. Meanwhile, down the bottom three, of course, being Burnley, last on 4 points, Everton, who are above them only on goal difference pending appeals, and a point better off Sheffield United. And then 4 points above those three teams, you've got the side in 17th place, who are Luton. Luton this weekend, facing Brentford away. It's first ever top flight meeting, excitingly, of those two sides. Luton fresh from that victory over Crystal Palace last weekend, which we didn't really talk too much about because we were too busy getting excited about Michael Olise's fantastic goal. But Luton are looking good. Burnley not so much. They host Sheffield United and could well become the first team in English Football League history, like ever, to lose the first 8 home games in a season. Also down there, Nottingham Forest are playing Everton. Sean Dyche actually started his playing career in Forest and is a Forest fan and is often to be seen around and about in Nottingham. There you go. So that'll be nice for him to take his Everton side there. Both matches were drawn last season. And then, of course, and not relevant to the relegation scrap particularly, there is West Ham against Crystal Palace, which, Rafi, you were so delighted to find out, is on TV 2 o'clock Sunday. Again, this features Michael Olise, If he scores another stunner like he did against Luton, we might get another post-game interview with him like the one he gave after this fixture with West Ham last season. Do you remember that? Went like this.
Just talk us through it.
Through what? The goal?
Mm.
I think Wolf passed me the ball. Shot. Scored.
Nice and brief. But it was a moment that captured the game, that won the game. And what's the feeling like when the ball does hit the back of the net?
It was a good feeling.
Do you feel you deserved it overall?
Yeah.
What did you think was the best?
Excellent.
Bit
the point.
Yeah, succinct. Too much talking around football, I say. There you go. West Ham, of course, have a Thursday night game against Bačka Topola. Thursday evening in the Europa League. I'm looking forward to that one this evening when we do the Europa and Conference League roundup.
Me too, James.
Yeah.
Pretty sure I've got their debut album, Bačka
Topola. Very nice. Anything else you want to say about the state of play ahead of this weekend, Colin?
Well, not on any particular game, but no Premier League managerial sackings so far this season.
Oh, yeah.
And it feels like this weekend might prompt a couple more questions. So it's the state of play, isn't it, in the bottom five or six. And we mentioned Luton's upturn in form. And Everton, well, albeit being in the bottom three, there's a sense that they probably have enough about them to get out of that.
Mm.
So you start to think what clubs are going to get sucked in to that. And obviously we've spoken about Nottingham Forest and Steve Cooper, who seems to be perennially on the verge of being sacked.
Well, Daniel Storey last weekend was saying he was very worried that if they get beaten by Everton, that could be it. But he says that pretty much every week.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. And then you kind of think, we've mentioned Burnley's dreadful run of form, and how invested are they in Vincent Kompany? It feels like after last season's success and after the TV show that they had, it kind of feels a little bit like they're not going to part ways. No,
but I wondered on Monday, and it wasn't entirely a joke, why, if you're heading down to the Championship, which they surely are, why would you get rid of the man who's performed so brilliantly for them there?
Well, wasn't there a lot of concern, though, whenever they got relegated a couple of seasons ago, that the nature of the takeover at Burnley suggested that if they were not regulars in the Premier League, their financial situation could get quite worrying.
You're right, yeah.
And also Sheffield United, of course, despite a couple of more positive performances recently, they're right down at the bottom. And I mean, like, because last season there were so many sackings, it was almost, I mean, it was Chelsea had three or four managers, Tottenham had three or four managers. It seemed to be every week there was a change, whereas this year the continuity is almost too much.
Right.
In a sense, it's gone too far the other way, whereby, I know it sounds silly to say.
Out with them, out.
It sounds silly to say it, and you never want to see,
there.
You never want to see people lose their jobs, but
I think
at
you
the
do.
Same, yeah, well, you sound disappointed, you vulture.
Well,
sitting there with your knitting.
A lot of fan bases might be getting a little bit anxious, and so might a few owners, but we'll see. I think this weekend might prompt the first.
Okay, well, drama. We'll be back on Sunday evening to round it all up. Rafa, you'll also be back on Tuesday when we have a look at what's going on around the continent. Some big games there. You've got Barcelona against Atletico Madrid, Napoli against Inter, and
Leverkusen Dortmund.
Ooh,
that's massive.
Massive. What day's that?
Sunday.
Sunday. Crikey. All right. Listen, I'm not sure what you have in the way of plans, but I hope it all goes splendidly and that we see you again late Sunday, early Monday for the Totally Football Show. For now, it's many, many thanks to you, to Colin, to Rafa, to Jack, to Charlie and Rachel in the booth. And from all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Discover bonus video content by searching for The Totally Football Show on YouTube and see the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally.
The Athletic.